Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us here tonight. My name is Aaron Moulton. I'm the senior curator here at the Utah Museum of Contemporary Art. And I have a cold, so I apologize in advance for sounding nasally. I'm very happy everyone could join us tonight for this Q&A with Jason Metcalf, who, if anyone hasn't seen it, has a solo exhibition in our Locals Only gallery. It's on until December 21st. And I'll give a small introduction to Jason. It's my own introduction, and then I'll just read his brief bio. I met Jason here around, I don't know, April or May. I just moved here in January, so I'm just getting to know the local art scene. And, I think immediately I identified with his work as that of an artist that if I was an artist, I might be making work like his. I think we have a lot of strong affinities in the interest that he's pursuing in his art and the interest that I pursue in curatorial practice, particularly playing with ideas of hoaxes and mythologies and systems of belief and politics of belief. And we've worked together on now on a couple projects, particularly this show that you'll see here in the Locals Only Gallery. We also did he was very instrumental in an exhibition we'll talk about tonight, which is called Each Memory Recalled Must Do Some Violence to Its Origins, which is in an undisclosed location somewhere in Utah. And so when I met with Jason, when we decided to do this exhibition here in the Locals Only Gallery, a lot of things started to come out of his mouth, that which I didn't know what to really buy into. He told me things that I still don't know what of it is real, and I want to like kind of revisit that a little bit as we talk here tonight. Jason Metcalf is from Salt Lake City. He graduated from BYU in sculpture. Metcalf has shown work at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, the Ghetto Biennial in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, at LACE in Los Angeles, the Scope Art Fair in New York, Quack in Ephraim, and he will be attending the Mountain School of Arts in LA in the spring. Please welcome Jason Metcalf. So we're here to talk about a lot about your exhibition, Abracadabra, which is here in the museum now. And I think we start with that, and then we move into other projects that kind of reference back to it or show other trajectories of research you're working on. I wonder, you know, the nature of Abracadabra is, just to sum it up for anyone who hasn't seen it, is kind of an anthropology of superstitions. And I guess I wanted to start off, and that's a very basic way to put it, because I think it's much more complex than that, but I wanted to start off by asking, are you superstitious?
Yeah, I am. And I don't, I mean, I think most people are, though. I mean, I wouldn't identify myself as being highly superstitious. Mm. Why do you ask that?
Well, I think it's a necessary question. Part of the attraction for me with this, I have always wanted to do an exhibition about superstition, because I do feel like it's a democratizing element that goes across cultures. I think it's probably the only thing, I'm sure someone will pipe up if I'm wrong, but I think it's one of the only things we can say we all have in common across different cultures, is we're all in some shape or form, whether Doubting Thomases or Zealots, in some shape or form superstitious. And even our architectures and designs of everyday life are in some degree constructed around superstitions that are some very known and some forgotten. So I think it's a very powerful and yet very universal thing to be dealing with. And so, I don't know, by asking...
Yeah. Well, and one thing that I'm really interested in with superstition is that it's this thing, by definition, that sits outside of any institution or any, like, specific culture. So, that's something that really interests me, and because of that, it does tie us together globally, I think. And, you know, I've some of the work, like the fingernails and the door hinge, it's the photo with the farthest one to the right up there. You can't really see it in this image. But But so that when I first started restaging superstitions as sculptures a couple years ago, I was living in Provo, Utah, and I found this book that is this archive of superstitions from Utah. It has 11,000 superstitious beliefs, and I find that I do research in a lot of other places as well on the internet and have a number of books and whatnot, but this was kind of a goldmine for me. And I found that, and it was specifically a Provo superstition, a Utah-based superstition that someone collected. I think it was from the, like, 50s or something. But then, and so, wow, I thought, this is kind of absurd and very interesting formally, so I want to recreate this as a sculpture. And I was interested in that pseudo-ostensive process, which we can talk about maybe. But anyway, the point is, so I found this thing, and then I moved to Haiti last year for about 6 months, and I was there, and I was talking to my friends, and we were talking about superstition, and I said, do you have any superstitious beliefs? And I said, and they're like, well, do you have an example of this? And so I brought that one up. And they said, oh, yeah, we do that here too. But in Provo, if you want to bring wealth to your household, that's what you do. You put fingernails in your door hinge. But in Haiti, if you're in need of food, then you do that, and you'll get an abundance of food. So I thought that was interesting that there were these two fairly... I mean, there is definitely a connection.
So if we could just speak generally about the exhibition, what is one looking at up there? I've already addressed it as an anthropology of superstition, but it is... You know, fairly indexical in a very specific way, right? It's based on your travels and places you've been.
Yeah.
Where are these all coming from?
Well, a lot of them are Utah based. Uh-huh. Because I started this project in Utah and I've been living in Utah mostly in the past few years. But some of them are generally American, from the South or wherever. But and then a lot of them are from Haiti as well. Because generally, what I've done is. I've mostly worked with beliefs and myths where I'm at as I'm working. So I won't, you know, I'm living in Phoenix right now, and I won't be making works about beliefs from Indiana, you know. Uh-huh. So I try to keep it local, and I think that that's a way to think about where I am and relate to my place. But it's part of like the theoretical creating these things as sculptural and formal objects, but also I'm interested in the possibility of these things having a magical property to them. And so a part of that process is that I have to make it where the place of origin is, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So these things become like site and time specific. So they're mostly Utah. This one's from Port-au-Prince.
This is one of the first images I saw, which I think really started to attract me to the project, which kind of falls within this body of work here. I think what really I found fascinating, though, is superstition is generally almost a verbal language, it's verbal in its existence, and yet it references performative and sculptural actions. You've already touched on the idea of using superstition to make sculpture, and I think that's really quite special. I wonder if you wanted to talk about that, what it means to render these objects in real time, or real space, just because I don't think that's typically happening. We all kind of knock on wood occasionally, but the objects are more things we reference in verbally, I feel.
Yeah, definitely these things, and you know, as I do my research, it's all verbal, really. I mean, sometimes I'll see things that are superstitious actions and all, but it's more rare. It's more these are definitely more verbal and written accounts, and I am interested. I'm not quite sure how to answer that, but I mean, yeah, for me, the physicalization of them is like really theoretically important because like part of why I'm interested in it is that, the initial thing that's driving this is that I'm interested in making these things physical. Like that's definitely a part of it. And so, but as I look at things, I'm really interested in the material properties of these things. So I'm not just looking at like, oh, that's an interesting belief, and or oh, that's a really absurd thing. As I'm reading these things, I'm imagining in my mind how it would materially unfold,
yeah,
and how I could create it. And one thing that a lot of people have said is, oh, these are just found objects or just found things. But I'm making material decisions; they're not just found things, like. A pile of salt in Utah is going to look a lot different than a pile of salt in Haiti based off of the material. But also, like, there's a lot of decisions that I make formally in how I arrange things and how I document them as well. And, I mean, and if you look at the show, I think that's fairly evident. Like, the yarrow plant, I mean, I'm looking at it as a sculpture as well, and it's not... so I don't know if that answers.
Well,
that.
I mean, I'm interested in the idea that are they props? Like they seem.
No, they're not props. No.
But they're kind of in a way they seem like placeholders for this superstition.
But they are the thing too. Like that's I'm interested. I mean they kind of are right. But I'm interested in these objects actually becoming the verbal thing because they're the physical manifestation of that. And so in a way, like I mean, so my interest is. In me physically recreating these things, they're becoming realized and they're becoming true through that creating. And then also, there's a third party that comes into it, which is the viewer. And as people view these things, whether it's the image or the physical object, then it's more real than it is a real thing, and it is, like, I have actually done this thing, and it could potentially produce the result that it's been prescribed to do, so... Mm-hmm. So it's not just a prop because I'm trying to think of an example in this show. And I mean, some of them are problematic, like the fishing net piece. You could theoretically look at that more as a prop because it's on a mannequin.
Uh-huh.
But I've actually worn that before.
Uh-huh.
And so as I'm wearing that, like maybe it is avoiding the evil eye.
Right.
And that's what I'm interested in is these things being sculptures, but also... in functioning potentially as this.
But I guess it comes back to the first question of whether you're superstitious, because and you can stop me if I'm wrong, my feeling was these were not made with the same superstitious intent that somebody who is zealously superstitious would render them with.
No, you're right. I'm not, I mean, I am superstitious. I mean, I say that like, I don't think anyone would say, that knows me really well, would say, oh, Jason Metcalf's really superstitious. But I'm just saying that because I think we all are.
Uh-huh.
I'm losing weight.
That's okay.
But you're right. I mean, I didn't wear the fishing net because I was trying to avoid the evil eye. But I'm interested in me. I'm interested in the potential of that, like, physical reenaction or an object that I make in... I'm interested in that possibility, but I'm not necessarily doing it because I want that result to happen personally for myself. But I want the viewer to be able to engage in that process as well. Does that make sense?
Oh, do you mind if we just do questions at the end? I mean, no sorry to cut it off, just because otherwise we'll detour.
Does that make sense, or...?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I guess the feeling is that there's this saturation point in the exhibition of, you know, all these things oscillating between good and evil that, you know, whether or not you're superstitious, I it's this third party situation that I find fascinating because, well, first of all, I don't know if anyone's noticed, we have not labeled things in a way that makes it immediately obvious which one is for the good and which one's for the evil and which one's, you know, for wealth and prosperity and whatnot. I think we've done a very nice thing in that you're meant to confront these things as objects first and foremost, as sculptures and situations, and then you have to refer to a single label to figure out which one it is, what it means, and then it suddenly shifts one way or the other for you that doesn't have immediately inherent meaning, because they aren't the most common superstitions. I think that's a nice part of the project. But I also think the saturation of them all in the one space, it's this funny, you know, cancellation.
Right, yeah, there's these, yeah. And I definitely design it that way. Like, I thought of, you know, there's these things that avoid evil and these things that promote certain things, and I wanted that balance, and kind of when we were choosing works, I kept that in mind. And I, just to back up a bit, yeah. I mean, I don't want to be totally, I don't want it to seem like I'm just totally some, when I say I'm not super, or that I am superstitious, but that I'm not doing these out of it, I'm open to the possibility in almost all of them. Some things are so absurd and I don't really see the possibility. And I don't know, maybe I'm just being redundant, but again, I'm not thinking, oh, I need to avoid the evil eye because someone gave me the evil eye. And I think the horse piece was the white horse is a good example because, like, as I was doing, like, it became so difficult that almost didn't work out. Uh-huh. And then once it happened, it's like, wow, maybe this is kind of lucky. Because yeah. It was really difficult to find a white horse. And it was, right. It wasn't really difficult, but, like, there were a lot of parameters and it almost didn't come together. Yeah. And that superstition was if you see a redheaded woman on a white horse, it's really good luck.
Yeah.
And I think that, and I've found that in a lot of different places. Yeah. It is a Utah thing, but
no,
it's a generally American thing. And so, again, I'm interested in that potential of that action, but then that's one where it's like, okay, maybe it is a pretty rare thing. I mean, so.
You said a word or a term earlier that I wonder if we could talk about and address a bit, because it's not one we used in the exhibition, because I thought it would be difficult to sum up, but I wonder if we could talk about it here, is the pseudo-extension. That was something you talked a lot about on our studio visit, and it seems very pertinent in the kind of work you do. Could you just tell the definition of it?
Yeah, so the pseudo-extension is a theory that folklorists use to describe a phenomenon where somebody perpetrates a hoax and then another party believes the hoax to be the fulfillment of a myth. So for instance, and how it all came about was in the 80s, there were all these satanic cults. I don't know if you remember the satanic cult scare in the 80s in America. Mm-hmm. So all these satanic cults started popping up everywhere and everyone started freaking out and it was all over the news and people thought that America was being taken over by Satanists because, you know, there were pigeon sacrifice everywhere. There were, you know, blood pentagrams and all these ritualistic things. And so the Christian community generally and a lot of America, which is the Christian community, got really up in arms about that. And then the more attention that was given to it, the more it happened. But then folklorists later were looking at it and they realized... The more people talked about these satanic cults, the more they showed up in different places. Uh-huh. But then folklorists were looking at it later, and what they realized was the initial satanic cults that started the whole thing were just teenagers that were totally trying to, like, scare their parents and their community members. And so they were perpetrating this hoax, but then it became this reality that everybody...
Right.
That, you know, a lot of America really bought into.
Uh-huh.
And so, anyway, so the pseudo-extension is, again, like when someone perpetrates a hoax and then people believe that and it becomes a reality or a truth for them. And so, for me, I was interested in superstition and I started restaging these superstitious rituals before I discovered that theory. And then later, as I did more research, I realized that that's what I was doing.
Uh-huh.
And it started to define, I mean, it didn't define it, but I was able to frame what I was doing within that theory. But that's what it is. And so with these objects, a lot of these objects and the performances that I do, that's the process. The perpetrator of a hoax, which doesn't totally work, I don't think. I mean, we can say that it works, that I'm producing hoaxes. But I'm the perpetrator, and then there's this other party that believes this thing. And that was my initial interest, and then also looking at all these things. Does that explain it?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I think another nice example that you used when we initially talked about it was the Halloween, the razors in Halloween candy.
Yeah, it's another one. Yeah.
Which was one that I remember from when I was a kid as well. And I even found, you know, little Satanist worship areas in random neighborhoods I was living in growing up. But I always thought the Halloween candy one was quite amazing
right.
because it's something you always heard about that. you know, don't take apples from strangers on Halloween because there might be razors in them. And the provenance of that is that the myth appears several years before the actual occurrence of actual razors appearing in apples. So I think that's a nice...
And so, yeah, so the reality became with people... And that one's complicated because the criminals that are actually, you know, trying to give kids drugs or whatever are really trying to harm them, but that's the same, yeah, the same process.
This is a performative sculpture we had at the opening, also known as a black cat, which Jason orchestrated that a man appear with a black cat. We didn't really organize it officially. I think that was a really nice part of this show is there's a lot that you don't see that was a part of it, and that's still a part of it, and you still don't see it. But I think the black cat is a great touchstone for the show because it's one of the few works that you immediately encounter that you identify with. It's like for beginners because it's a common thing that we all respond to. Whether or not we avoid its path, we still understand that its path is to be avoided. And so I start talking about this, but I wonder, you know, there's these other ones that I'm. Could you tell about this one?
So the belief with this is that if you receive a stamp, like a letter in the mail with a stamp that's upside down on it, you know that there's a lie in the letter.
And what's in the letter?
Do you want me to tell you? It's the exhibition card, actually. So
I think that's been my own little, our own little secret for this in a funny way is the issues at work in this pseudo-ostensive process that you've been dealing with and how that plays into this exhibition because it is, one is confronted with what seems like a, not by any means comprehensive index, but thorough index of ideas of superstition across cultures in a way that, you know, I wouldn't question them, but we should.
We should question.
It's an idea of, by association, by having the black cat, it enforces and endorses the letter, which endorses the CD.
Right.
And this is, if I'm not mistaken, if you want to rid yourself of a bad energy or a curse, you put whatever the manifestation is of it onto a CD and then destroy it. So it's,
well, it's just a thing, like anything.
Ah, okay.
But it could be that.
Right, okay.
I mean, it could be like... I mean, things get pretty dark, actually. I try to keep the show not really dark, because...
Yeah, because we're a public institution. And,
right. But, I mean, there's a lot of ways to, like, you know, rid your life of someone, or whatever that means. I mean, it can mean, you know... But generally what I found is that, like, there's a lot of rituals work for people or for objects or for, like to get rid of a headache, you could also use that for an individual or for, anyway, so generally with this, it's destroy it beyond readability. And then it's, and that's, I don't want to get too much into like different types of magic, but that's one way is that you're transferring like an action is symbolic for the thing that you want to happen, and so as you're destroying this data on this thing, it's then going to carry over into whatever you're trying to get rid of. Makes sense.
But in terms of, you know, trying to differentiate, we don't have to identify specifics, but there's a small number of things up there that aren't real.
I've been interested in... And with this exhibition, it's the first that I've started to do this. I've started to create my own superstitious things. And so, but yeah, it's definitely there are things in the exhibition that are a part of that. And I've learned the vocabulary, like the visual vocabulary of magic and like folk belief, then I'm able to start to really I have been able to start to do that, and but which I was really hesitant to do it, but I'm interested in it as a sculptor, as an artist, yeah. because then I'm really looking at things materially and formally.
Yeah.
And the belief, I mean, I'm also creating this belief as well, and then, and you know, as I watch people go through it, or as I hear people talk about it, they say, oh, I didn't know that this, you know, was what this was.
Yeah.
Whether or not they believe it, they believe that that's a thing, and most of it are real beliefs.
Right.
But also, I mean, it gets really tricky because a superstitious belief is just, for it to qualify, is that's just one person has to believe it. It's not like exactly. It has to be a commonly held thing.
Right.
And in fact, if it's a commonly held thing, it's not a superstition.
Right.
So as I start to create these things, then they become, I mean, isn't that as valid as someone else saying that it's?
Sure. No. I mean, I carry lucky coins and all that. I mean,
right.
I didn't get that from anybody, but I'm sure other people do it. But I think it's a nice thing that you're evolving the language of potentials and superstition. But I, it's weird. For the last week, I've been in these conversations. We had here a week ago Triple Candy, who's got the exhibition next door, and we did a Q&A with them. And then the day after, I was with Alex Israel in Miami to do a Q&A with him. And and now here I am with you, and I feel like there's so much weirdness in common between you three. One of the main ideas I've taken away from it is how something performs the role of your sculpture, which is this funny tie, and I think that crosses the three of you, in that it's somehow it's something that you could sort of bring into being at any moment, or you know, it comes back to the idea of the prop to some degree. One thing that I think we should talk about is how it relates to the issues of the ready-made, because I think that's been a pretty maybe challenging. I mean, if we're to take Facebook as a litmus test for public opinion, it's been it's been a challenge, I think, for people to accept these things as artworks, let alone superstitions.
Right.
And I just wondered if you had any thing you wanted to say about how this relates to a history of the ready-made.
I mean, I think that like the possibility of these works is definitely like owed to the ready-made, but I mean, these aren't, they're not just ready-mades either, you know. Mm. And so, I mean, I think that's an interesting conversation to have if someone doesn't understand that. The idea of the ready-made, and what you're saying, I mean, there have been people that have been like, this isn't art because it's just a CD or it's a feather duster on a, you know, and just because it has meaning, like it's not art. But they're looking at, I mean, it's just such a basic question, and that if they don't understand that, then, I mean, I think there's a lot of work out there being made that
deserves even more.
Yeah, and also with these, some of them are more ready-made than others, but like the fishing net, I mean, I'm transforming that. I tied 40 knots in that fishing net.
I've seen them.
And so, I mean, that's not totally the ready-made, right? Because I'm not just saying this thing.
No, you're intersecting these languages. Right. I mean,
so, I mean, there is manipulation there. It's not as, developed as, you know, as a lot of artwork being made today, but there are, I mean, I scratched the CD and like the wax on the table, I mean, I'm doing something with it and I'm combining materials. And so I would say that they're not totally, well, you know.
I mean, handcraft aside, I think there's a clear infusion of this energy that you hope exists within them by the process of making them, you know, or realizing superstitions in real space. I think already that brings them into a place that's beyond the pure point-and-shoot, random, ready-made object.
Well, and I would say that, I mean, everyone that's brought up the ready-made argument with these has talked about the material or the object, but I would say if they're ready-mades at all, it's more a ready-made scenario, or the ready-made, you know, it's this verbal description, and then I'm actualizing it, you know what I mean? It's mm-hmm. So I think it's more conceptually ready-made than You know, I don't just go into Walmart and choose a CD, but it's this other thing that dictates that. So. Uh-huh. Anyway.
Maybe we could talk about this work. I mean, you did talk about it a little bit already, but it's a work we produced for the opening of the exhibition. And it's it seems like something that lives quite large in local culture. What could you tell us what it is? Just again,
Yeah. So the superstition with this is if you see a redheaded woman on a white horse, it's very good luck. And so I got a permit from the city to block off the street in front of the museum. It was supposed to be one lane, but they ended up blocking off the whole one direction of traffic. You can see the police vehicle there. And then I got this horse and this redheaded woman, girl, and had her walk all the way down, like from the beginning of the block, so all the way down the block and back. And there were people who came, and it was unannounced. We didn't say this is a performance or anything.
Yeah, right.
Because, again, part of the idea was to hope that this thing might... Well, again, I'm not necessarily... That's wrong. I wasn't hoping that it would be true, but I'm open to that possibility. So, and there was a lot of people... I think there was a symphony or something.
Yeah.
So a lot of people just randomly came upon it, and most people didn't notice, which is kind of weird, because... I thought it was absurd, but maybe it wasn't so absurd.
Right.
And some people did, and were kind of like, what's going on? But yeah, so that's what that was.
Yeah, I really like the idea of the uninformed passerby in this case, just because it, I'm not from here, but it seems like something that would mean something. Because it was a, you know, it was a clockwork production that we had where the horse would arrive at 7:30, the model would be there, the cops would shut down the street at 7:45, and they'd do the walk from 7:45 to 7:55, and so at around 7:30.
Oh, and we bagged all the meters on the street.
We bagged all the meters. We shut the street down, so there wouldn't be any cars there. And this is more an anecdote than anything, but at around 7:30, as things start to get into motion, there's one car that's parked in front of the museum that, you know, for some reason was there, in spite of the fact that we had bagged all the meters, and the license plate said anathema, which I thought was this bizarre coincidence that, you know, I still really don't know the nature of, and I don't really want to question, but it felt something a bit too serendipitous to be true. And anathema is an ecclesiastical curse. And so it was this thing where I suddenly had my mind blown in this production process where we have an ecclesiastical curse in front of an ecclesiastical blessing, which I thought was quite special. And nobody knows who owned that car to begin with. So we're going to return to the lemon with the nail for a second. Jason and I, as well as Adam Bateman here, and Vanessa, and Becca, and Sam, and several others, I curated an exhibition and had their very gracious help in doing it in an abandoned house in a kind of ghost town. It's an undisclosed location here in Utah. And the exhibition's called "Each Memory Recalled Must Do Some Violence to Its Origins," and the idea was something that, you know, comes from my being here, which I feel, you know, somewhat isolated from the world I've been in before, and I started to think about what it means to do exhibitions here and deal with contemporary art here when I don't feel the international or national public really come here. So, you know, it's like the spiral jetty phenomenon, essentially. Everybody knows it, but no one's ever seen it. And so I thought, well, why not make an exhibition that no one will ever see? So I don't disclose the location of it, and it's there forever. And essentially the idea of the exhibition was to embrace certain elements of entropy and post-civilizational sort of disorder. And it was an exhibition that came out of, at least when I met with Jason, it kind of gave me a big mental push to go forward with it, because he had
sorry, I'll just forward to this. Done this work here. We'll come back and talk about this, but this was a great image on his website, which was a painting he abandoned on the side of this barn, and I thought, that's brilliant, you know, and I'd been wanting to, like, address this situation of isolation and desolation and forever, and so so we put this together one September afternoon. So one of the works that Jason had two works in the show, which was again our lemon. My ideal scenario with this show is that it's made for the random person that finds it and who doesn't have any introduction to it. And in a way, it comes out of, you know, talking to him about pseudo-ostension, that this would become the satanic house or the, you know, a hobo shaman's dwelling or something. And so, you know, he put one of his limes with a nail through it on the windowsill.
It is pretty evil, too, the house.
The house is pretty, it's pretty great. It's a beautiful, beautiful house. And we also have this work here, which there's technically a work on the door there, but this is also a piece by Jason, which references a piece you made, I don't know how long ago it was, but when is this work from?
2011? 2011? Yeah.
Okay. So I don't know if anyone can see it so well, but maybe you could describe what we're looking at and where the... And then we can start to unpack the details of it.
Yeah, so this is a photo that I found while doing Bigfoot research in San Pete County. I was invited to do this exhibition at Quack and had spent a lot of time down there. At Adam runs the Birch Creek residency there and with Quack and everything. And so I was so I started doing Bigfoot research because I was interested in the how... So, I'm sure a lot of people are familiar with this, but it's Mormon folklore. It's not a Mormon doctrine necessarily. Well, it's somewhere in between the two, which really interested me. But there's a belief that Cain was cursed to roam the earth until the end of days, and that he's tall and that he has dark skin. He was cursed with a skin of blackness, and that he's hairy. Some describe him as being very hairy. So a lot of people think that the predominance of Bigfoot sightings, especially since, I mean, well, I won't get into, like, the history of Bigfoot sightings, but that the reason why there's so many Bigfoot sightings is that this is actually Cain that we're seeing running around. And there's a lot of Bigfoot sightings in Utah. And so so I was interested in that local version of the myth. So I started doing research, and then I found this photograph. But I actually didn't find it. I fabricated it, which you probably all guessed. But and Adam helped me. Adam took this photograph. So we went up to Ephraim Canyon, and I bought this Bigfoot suit off Amazon.com and ran around San Pete County for a day and used... I had, like, two or three different cameras with different film, different sizes of film, different all the different variables, and we went to about... I don't know, we spent like a whole day running around. And then I chose one photograph to be this object. And so, and if you notice, the edges of it are kind of messed up, and there's a fold. You can't really see the fold. And there's fingerprints.
If anyone who can't see it, this is Bigfoot here, just so you know.
Short Bigfoot. Master of Maine.
Very short Bigfoot.
So anyway, so the idea is that, so I had this whole narrative that I just told you guys, and that was on the text panel on the wall.
But you just said Master Mayhem. You didn't talk about him before.
Oh, did I not say Master Mayhem? Oh, sorry, Cain. Okay, sorry. So, again, and it's something that Joseph Smith said, but, again, there's, like, doctrine and there's this myth, and I was really interested in how this thing became myth, which there's a lot of that in a lot of different religious cultures, but... But so when Cain made a pact with Satan to kill Abel, I don't know exactly when, but he received a new name, which was Master Mayhem, which means Master Destroyer, because he became like a son of perdition and became, I mean, there's more myth into that, but, and so therefore he was cursed to roam the earth and begs people to kill him because when there's fingerprints.
If anyone who can't see it, this is Bigfoot here, just so you know.
Master of Maine.
A very short Bigfoot.
So anyway, so the idea is that, so I had this whole narrative that I just told you guys, and that was on the text panel on the wall.
But you just said Master Mayhem. You didn't talk about him before.
Oh, did I not say Master Mayhem? Oh, sorry, Kane. Okay, sorry. So, again, and it's something that Joseph Smith said, but, again, there's, like, doctrine and there's this myth, and I was really interested in how this thing became myth, which there's a lot of that in a lot of different religious cultures, but so when Cain made a pact with Satan to kill Abel, I don't know exactly when, but he received a new name, which was Master Mayhem, which means Master Destroyer, because he became, like, a son of perdition and became, I mean, there's more myth into that, but, and so therefore he was cursed to roam the earth and begs people to kill him because he wants to be rid of this curse. And so, anyway, so so the piece is called The Curse of Master Mayhem. And again, so I created this photograph, but it's actually, I kind of see it more as a sculpture because the physical photograph, like, it's important to look at it physically because there's fingerprints on it and there's this whole thing. And so the object itself becomes a part of that narrative because it's this old screwed up photograph, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah.
And so this was in the show at Quack, and there was a cabin, which was this old pioneer cabin that they turned into a gallery. And so it was just this pinned on the wall. And then outside, or upstairs, or in the main exhibition space, there were these quilt barn paintings. I saw these as talismanic objects, but I was also, which they are, but I was also interested in the formal properties of these quilt barn paintings. People put quilt barn paintings all on their barns to ward off evil spirits, is what people think the original reason for that is, but now they become this decorative thing that if you drive through Pennsylvania, you'll see them all over barns. And there was one, there's not that many in Utah, but there was one that I saw in Spring City near Adam's old house, and there was this exhibition of this painter that they had a Quack named Leo Krikorian who made these hard-edge abstractions. It was a part of the Black Mountain College and studied under Albers and whatnot. And I was looking at the two, and I'm like, they're exactly the same thing. And I was interested in that there's this folk form that's been passed down in these patterns, these geometric patterns. And here we've arrived at this one form of these paintings on these barns, and then we have these high modern geometric abstraction paintings, and they're really the same formally, but they've come from two totally different places. And so I switched the two, and I placed the quilt barn paintings in. So these are quilt block patterns; they're actual quilt block patterns, and I put them on canvases, and then I put abstract paintings on barns. So the one we were looking at was a alteration of an Ellsworth Kelly.
Okay.
So anyway, but not to go all into that, but I saw like you were saying in this show, there was like this dualistic, these forces that were fighting. I purposefully wanted to do that in this exhibition as well, where there was this Master Mayhem, which is the pure representation of evil on the earth, and then these talismanic objects that could potentially ward off that figure, that Roman figure from your property. So they both take place in the pastoral
We've kind of moved quite far from Master Mayhem, but I mean, I was, I think, well, how to say it, I really was still interested in the potential of this project, and you kindly offered up the suit, and so this is a sort of a conclusion, maybe, to the man.
Yeah, I mean, it's revealing the hoax, and I mean, I like it sculpturally. I think it's an interesting thing, and also, like, yeah, it becomes the lair or the place of. I mean, I could go put it back on and suit up, or and I just went there. It's still there, actually, but yeah.
The first moment not that I want to paint you to be a liar or anything, but I had a hilarious experience after our studio visit where I was with Trent Harris for beers, and And I started telling him the story of Master Mayhem, you know, verbatim. And he was like, what the hell are you talking about? Like, I've never heard that story. And the guy's pretty well read for the region. And suddenly, as he's, you know, questioning what the hell I'm talking about, I started to have this small echo of Jason telling me he had made modifications to Wikipedia pages and done things to help extend or reinforce or help mythologies come into being or, you know, further their potential. It's not really a question. It was just this funny moment of... I have since found references to Master Mayhem on my own, but I did love this moment of believing in Master Mayhem and then wondering whether that was, you know, just my gullibility, and then... And now I believe. What do we have next? So we'll maybe keep it going for another 10 minutes, and we'll open it up for questions. This is a relatively recent work that you've made that was in an exhibition curated by Adam Bateman in New York. Quite a special piece, falling into the realm of the White Horse. And can you describe it? What are we looking at?
Well, as you can see, like a lot of the work, I think the Master Mayhem and some of the work in the show is tied to Mormon folklore, because I've been mostly in Utah and have been making work that deals with superstition and myth here, and so it's a predominant force. And this piece is even more so directly related to that, I would say, more than any of the works I've made. And it's still pseudo-ostensive in that way, but not totally the same. So what this is, it's a physicalization of this object so in the Old Testament there was the Ark of the Covenant, and on the Ark of the Covenant there was the mercy seat, which is a gold-plated piece of wood. I forget which kind of wood it was. I'm sure someone here would know. But and that's where God appeared to man to the, like, during the Day of Atonement or whenever that happened. And I remember, so I went on a Mormon mission, and I remember this guy was telling me, he was like, yeah, so when Jesus came and he appeared to Joseph Smith, he appeared over pure gold, because gold is, like, because this is art that Jesus, God, can appear on earth, is to appear over gold, because there needs to be that purity there. And I don't know if it's standing or how that works, or if it is even a real thing. But in the Doctrine and Covenants, when there's this account where Christ appears to Joseph Smith in the Kirtland Temple, and it says that that he appeared over a work paved in pure gold. So I was interested in that material property of gold as being this, like, divine conductor, or this divine this substance that, I mean, it's at once, like, earthly, but it's also this divine thing that's, you know, could exist in the place of God. Like, we hear about the paved streets of gold and whatnot. And again, I was interested in this object functioning potentially as that. And I didn't mean it in a blasphemous way by any means, but again, I'm interested in the material substance. And so I had this aerospace company in Phoenix. They gold plate things for the space shuttle and whatnot. They polished and plated a 1-foot by 1-foot tile of aerospace aluminum, and it's with 99.99% pure gold or something. And it has a mirror finish, so you can see a reflection in it. Do you have the image of when it's on the wall?
No, this is the only one I have, but it does really reflect.
So I lit it, and it instantly just lit up the entire wall because it's so reflective and radiant. Yeah. But I'm not really trying to, like, induce an appearance or anything, but I'm interested in that. Again, it's related to all this other work because it could function as this thing, but it's also a formal thing that relates to minimalism and Carl Andre's tiles and all that. So, yeah.
I guess, you know, I just want to sort of wrap it up a bit by just asking a question that I ask myself quite a bit, being a kind of foreigner here, because I do feel, I can't imagine I would have moved to any other place in America other than Utah. I think it's an incredibly special place that really differentiates itself in a very special way, and I started, like, you know, I think from Europe, when you see America, it's LA and New York with kind of gray in between, and I think being here, I really have come to realize that the real spectrum of America is Las Vegas and Salt Lake City, in terms of really addressing the capabilities of what America is and can be, from all, it's hyper-conservative to hyper-liberal, and New York and LA are somewhere on the hyper-liberal side. But I think being here, and hyper-conservative, of course, is an exaggeration, but it is a very special place for a lot of the cultural conditions that relate to it, from the church to the mountains. And so what I've noticed is that there are a lot of artists making work that I think are inherently in their DNA from Utah, and the kind of topics they're dealing with and the ideas that they're employing. And the question I always have is, are you ever concerned about whether your work translates? Because I think there's a very, it's so site-specific and so culturally specific. I'm just wondering, you know, give or take some exoticization in a foreign context, how do you see your work translating?
Yeah, that's a question I've gotten, and I'm not totally sure of the answer. And again, like I would say, like I said a moment ago, I mean, this work and the Master Mahan work very directly deal with Utah things, but like the Quilt Barn paintings, for instance, like, I have friends in Europe and a lot of people that instantly relate to those, and they understand it and I can explain it. And a lot of the superstitious things in this exhibition, I think, can be read outside of the... And so I think there's... I mean, this piece is problematic to discuss because it requires all that knowledge outside of it, and I'm happy to give that and explain that. But at the same time, people were responding to it really well at this opening, and They, I mean, it was so radiant and so beautiful and so, which I don't really make beautiful things, but
don't,
it was
don't
just,
say that. Don't say that.
Oh, but it was so, I mean, I don't want it necessarily beautiful, but precious or like slick things. So there was a response, and yeah, it required an additional translation, but I'm totally fine with that. And I think that my work, I mean, it doesn't have to be totally easy for everybody, and I think that, some projects I'm working on now, and a lot of my work in the past couple of years has carried some of that local, I mean, not local language, but some of those properties that you're discussing, but has also opened up in other ways, and I'm trying to do that, so I don't know if that answers it or...
Oh, that's good. And I guess the last question is, are you evil?
Yes, I am evil.
maybe we can open it up for questions. If anybody, Adam, you had a question, I cut you off early on, but maybe we can return to that question now.
Yeah, my question was along the lines of belief in what you're doing, and... I was kind of hoping, Jason, you would tell these guys about your piece where you blessed Tom Friedman's pedestal, and about your interaction with him, and then address for me, and with that particular piece has been really interesting. You'll tell about it, but you know, as I've been with you and it's been discussed with people like Rob Nickus, for example, and when I discussed it with Andrea Zappel, these two like prominent art world figures, they were both like, wait, was this witch powerful enough for that? And like, that's really amazing. Did you really believe that? You know, there are these questions about sincere belief from these like sort of otherwise sort of like cynical liberal people that was kind of really surprising about the context of this piece. And at the same time, and I think that there's something about what happened when you blessed that pedestal piece and then discovered that Tom Friedman didn't actually curse it.
He did curse it.
Well, maybe he cursed one, but the other ones
he didn't. The other one he didn't, yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
But the fact that he didn't curse one of them at least raises questions for me about whether others were cursed, right?
Right.
I mean, or what, and then there's something about honesty in the work, and like...
Well, and they, yeah,
and,
yeah.
And so there's this, there are all these questions between, and particularly in your work, where there's some sort of like thing with conceptual art, where if you don't go through the conceptual rigor, then the work's meaningless. On the other hand, and then with your work, there's this extreme of if you actually really believed in every one of these mythologies, then it sort of ceases to become art in a way.
Right.
And I kind of like want to hear how you address where you fit on that spectrum. And what problems you find between those two things. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense.
If you said it in 10 words or less, what would your question be?
No, it makes sense. I mean, what you're saying is like...
Do you want to fight?
I mean, it comes back to the belief question, and, like, I do believe in certain things, and I am superstitious in certain ways, but when it comes to my work... I am not doing these things. I'm not. A lot of these things are actions. I'm not doing these things because I'm believing in it at that moment and trying to. It's not about my belief, but it's about belief. It's about the process of belief and about this third party believing it and the belief of the individual who the origin of the superstition. So, like with Tom Friedman's. Piece, for instance. So Tom, I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with this, but he created this. He hired a witch to curse a spate, like an 11-inch sphere above a pedestal, and so it was called Curse Space, or Untitled a Curse. And so the space became the sculpture, and when he ships it with, so the crate has a space above it, so that the curse is there in the crate. So he's interested in the sculptural property of that curse and of this invisible thing. And so I was interested in, like, erasing that in a way, but my belief wasn't necessary for that process to happen. Because all I did was I hired someone who was able to erase what he had done. And initially he did do it. Later, as Adam said, there was if you'll see multiples of it, if you ever see it, in exhibition, at least from like the times that it's shown in exhibition since it sold at auction, they've all been like he didn't have them recursed because it's sold to an anonymous collector and he doesn't know where it is and he can't get it for exhibitions, and so he just sends a pedestal out and doesn't have it recursed. And I think that question you're saying, I mean, I think that's the key thing there. Like, do you follow through conceptually and and I think that's where the sincerity lies and the integrity in the work. And for me, that's definitely how it is as well. Like, I'm actually doing these things. So if I say I do something, then I'm doing it. Like, I didn't Photoshop. I could have easily Photoshopped myself in the costume, but I didn't. So there's this physical thing, and I'm saying that it was this thing, and whether or not it is. Does that make sense? And to get to your... I mean, I know you were asking more about my belief and where I sit with this. And again, I mean, yeah, I do believe. I have my own beliefs and my own superstitions. They're not as absurd as what a lot of this work is. Like, I don't...
that's the tricky part, right? That's kind of what I'm getting at, is, like, no one's superstitions are absurd to them.
Right.
Right? And so that's part of the question of belief and versus sort of, like...
But our whole business is about cultural artifacts that are faith objects, ultimately. I mean, all of art history, you know, will be wiped clean by a dominant next civilization. I mean, these are only things that we hold dear. So I think that it really zooms back on the whole topic of faith objects in general, but not necessarily something you need to follow through with.
So that's the answer you would give.
Yeah, that's right. That's the answer I would give.
So are you asking, like, where is the stress of importance? Is it, like, what the audience brings to each work or what you bring to them? Is that, like, what you're trying to ask?
No, I know what you're trying to ask. I've tried to discuss that earlier, but, like, again, like, so if I reenact a superstition, I'm not doing it because I want that thing to happen personally for myself, but I am the perpetrator of the hoax. And I'm using that word in this instance because it works with the things that I've talked about, but I don't think they're not hoaxes, they're something different. But to answer your question, so I am the hoaxer, and there's the original person who prescribed a belief, and they believe in it, and then another party could believe that as well. So that's where the belief comes in, and it is about belief, because those beliefs are necessary for this thing to have these other properties beyond its, like, physical realization. So it's about belief, but it's not about my personal belief. Because you're right, if I was just doing all these things and documenting it, then it'd just be my superstitions. They wouldn't be artwork.
Have you ever done one with your superstitions?
No, I haven't.
So, in your exhibition, there's a picture of the corner of a room. Maybe it's a ceiling and two walls, and there's a tangle of spider webs and spiders there. I was wondering where you took the picture and what exactly that means.
So that was in Provo. And that's, if you have spider webs in your household, it's a sign of great wealth.
I think I've heard that from, like, Southern culture, too. That's where it comes from.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, like, if you wrote the book, Huck Finn.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
There's reference.
Oh, it's in there. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's interesting. Cool. Cool. Thanks.
Does anyone else have a question?
I do. Do you feel that a certain level of absurdity is necessary for some of these, like, hex breakers or whatever you want to call them, these superstitions? I feel like absurdity is almost a requirement to sort of ward off some of these things. Otherwise, you could do any, you know, you just breathe through my nose or something and then it would go away. But people put, like, 2-liter jugs of water on their, like, power meter in South America because it saves them money on their power bill, and, like, we hold our breaths when we go through tunnels and, like, cheese it when you see the cops, or, you know, these things that are just, they're absurd, really.
Right.
I'm wondering how you feel the relationship between absurdity is to the superstition, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, I can tell you what I've seen in my research and observations, and it's my opinion, but, I mean, again, like, the definition of superstition is that it's a belief that's not a common belief, and that it's without the confines of, like, an institutional system or an organization or whatever. Because if something's a doctrine, or if it's a canonized belief, then it's not superstition. And so maybe that's why I'm just hypothesizing, but maybe that's why things are absurd, is because that's kind of what absurdity is that it's not a part of something. So, and then also I would say, like, a lot of these physical things are, at least my observation, isn't have it recursed. And I think that question you're saying, I mean, I think that's the key thing there. Like, do you follow through conceptually? And I think that's where the sincerity lies and the integrity in the work. And for me, that's definitely how it is as well. Like, I'm actually doing these things. So if I say I do something, then I'm doing it. Like, I didn't Photoshop. I could have easily Photoshopped myself in the costume, but I didn't. So there was this physical thing, and I'm saying that it was this thing, and whether or not it is. Does that make sense? And to get to your, I mean, I know you were asking more about my belief and where I sit with this, and again, I mean, yeah, I do believe. I have my own beliefs and my own superstitions. They're not as absurd as what a lot of this work is. Like, I don't...
That's the tricky part, right? That's kind of what I'm getting at, is, like, no one's superstitions are absurd to them.
Right.
Right? And so and so that's part of the question of belief, and versus sort of like.
But our whole business is about cultural artifacts that are faith objects. Ultimately, I mean, all of art history, you know, will be wiped clean by a dominant next civilization. I mean, these are only things that we hold dear. So I think that it really zooms back on the whole topic of faith objects in general, not necessarily something you need to follow through with.
But that's the answer you would give.
Yeah, that's right. That's the answer I would give.
So are you asking, like, where is the stressed importance? Is it, like, what the audience brings to each work or what you bring to them? Is that, like, what you're trying to ask?
No, I know what you're trying to ask. I actually tried to discuss that earlier, but, like, again, like, so if I reenact a superstition, I'm not doing it because I want that thing to happen personally for myself, but I am the perpetrator of the hoax. And I'm using that word in this instance because it works with the things that I've talked about, but I don't think they're not hoaxes, they're something different. But to answer your question, so I am the hoaxer, and there's the original person who prescribed the belief, and they believe in it, and then another party could believe that as well. So that's where the belief comes in, and it is about belief, because those beliefs are necessary for this thing to have these other properties beyond its, like, physical realization. So it's about belief, but it's not about my personal belief. Because you're right, if I was just doing all these things and documenting it, then it'd just be my superstitions. They wouldn't be artwork.
Have you ever done one with your superstitions?
No, I haven't.
So, in your exhibition, there's a picture of the corner of a room. Maybe it's a ceiling and two walls, and there's a tangle of spider webs and spiders there. I was wondering where you took the picture and what exactly that means.
So that was in Provo. And that's, if you have spider webs in your household, it's a sign of great wealth.
I think I've heard that from, like, Southern culture, too. That's where it comes from.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yeah, like, if you wrote the book Huck Finn,
oh, yeah.
There's reference.
Oh, it's in there. Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, interesting. Cool. Cool. Thanks.
Does anyone else have a question?
I do. Do you feel that a certain level of absurdity is necessary for some of these, like, hex breakers or whatever you want to call them, these superstitions? I feel like absurdity is almost a requirement to sort of ward off some of these things. Otherwise, you could do any, you know, I could just breathe through my nose or something and then it would go away. But people put, like, 2-liter jugs of water on their power meter in South America because it saves them money on their power bill, and, like, we hold our breaths when we go through tunnels and, like, cheese it when you see the cops, or, you know, these things that are just, they're absurd, really.
Right.
I'm wondering what you, like, what, how you feel the relationship between absurdity is to the superstition, I guess.
I don't know. I mean, I can tell you what I've seen in my research and observations, and it's my opinion, but, I mean, again, like, the definition of superstition is that it's a belief that's not a common belief, and that it's without the confines of, like, an institutional system or an organization or whatever. Because if something's a doctrine, or if it's a canonized belief, then it's not superstition. And so maybe that's why I'm just hypothesizing, but maybe that's why things are absurd, is because that's kind of what absurdity is that it's not a part of something. So, and then also I would say, like, a lot of these physical things are, at least my observation, like, when there's physical rituals, they seem to be more absurd in nature. And part of it's that you're, and again, this is all my, I'm not a folklorist, but a lot of it's that you're doing something out of the ordinary, right? I mean, if you're just doing an everyday thing that couldn't have another potential meaning, then it wouldn't be powerful. So I think, I don't think the absurdity is required, but I think that things are absurd because of what superstition is and how it functions. So.
Hey, Jason?
Yeah.
I read this book by John Allaire that was saying that like an NFL quarterback doesn't make a rational decision in a tight spot in a game. If he did, he'd get tackled. You know, it's like another part of your brain that runs that sort of thing. Do you think that the irrationality of superstitions is perhaps a necessary thing? Like, not something that is, you know, responsible for the ills in society, but maybe an intuitive thing that is actually necessary.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I would say, so again, I'm not a folklorist, but I think that, yeah. Sorry, I don't know how to expound upon it. I mean, I think you said it, and I agree with you totally. So.
Anyone else? Well, thank you so much for coming. Jason, thanks so much for being here. And we're open still for another hour or two. So if you have any other questions, we'll be up there in the hallway. So thanks so much.